Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. We've had some dope episodes in the past, and today is just like the rest of them, just an amazing episode. We'll be interviewing the New Georgia Project's Executive Director, Insay Ufot, to talk about Georgia politics and voting rights. You know, voting rights are a huge issue, not just in Georgia, but across the country. We'll dig into all of that. But before we get to Insay, I wanted to talk about the economy, particularly the news last week. The prices are moving up. The job numbers weren't what we thought they'd be. And you're already starting to see Republican talking points emerge that are seeking to slow down the Biden economic agenda. In case you missed it, the April jobs report showed that the U.S. economy added 266,000 jobs at a time when economists expected the economy to add almost 1 million jobs. At the same time, we saw prices raise about 0.8% in April, an increase of about 4.2% compared to this time last year. This was the highest increase in prices of things like gas, food, clothing, etc. since 2008. So the first thing we hear from Republicans is that the additional $300 in unemployment assistance unemployed Americans are receiving is why we're seeing slower than expected job growth. And they're saying that the Biden economic agenda is too ambitious and is pushing prices too high with the economy potentially overheating. So that's BS. But for starters, there's an easy solution to slow job growth, and that's raising wages to make it worth people's time to work in the middle of a pandemic. Attacking temporary unemployment assistance when Americans are still looking for work and recovering from a pandemic is short-sighted. Equally short-sighted is taking a month of data around inflation when we're still well below the rate the Fed targets before they'll raise interest rates, and taking that to mean that we shouldn't invest in our infrastructure or in our families and communities is just as silly as it sounds. Republicans are grasping for straws on this one. Prices should go up when we've been in the house for a year. We want to spend money, and that's a good thing. And wages have been stagnant for years. So if working people are finally getting the raise that helps them make ends meet, that's a good thing too. Democrats shouldn't shy away from that. It's something to take pride in and to keep pushing for more, because we won't win in 2022 and 2024 by being shy. We're in power and we should act like it. And that's that on that. Now on to my sister Insay for a dope episode on all things you need to know about voting rights and how to organize, particularly in the Deep South.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. We actually have a dope guest on today who is going to walk us through what it means when you have those ideas about activism and policy and grassroots activism and how to actually make it work and change the world. Shout out to the homie Insay. What's going on? How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, we start each one of our episodes the same way because I want people to understand your background and where you come from. You've been a corporate lawyer, a labor lawyer, a lobbyist, a community organizer, and now you're the nonprofit executive as the executive director of the New Georgia Project. What led you to the work that you do now? And what was it about the New Georgia Project that attracted you after making all these various stops?
Yeah, I am born in Nigeria, raised in Southwest Atlanta. I'm an Atlanta Public School graduate.
It's a little different. That's a little different than Nigeria to Southwest, the SWATs.
Yeah, Nigeria to the SWATs. I tell people that I am a Southerner twice. I was born in Southern Nigeria and raised in the Southern part of the United States. And I think, you know, when my mom and I made the decision that like we would become US citizens, you know, getting ready, looking at high school graduation, wanting to make sure that I, you know, coming from a working class immigrant family, single mom, that I wanted to get access to all the resources that I could in order to continue my education. And so my mom got a third job to hire an attorney to sort of navigate us through the process. And I was responsible for making sure that we passed the citizenship exam, that she wasn't going to embarrass me. We were both going to pass. And, you know, I think that I feel like that's a clear sort of jumping start moment for me in thinking about the sort of gap between the rhetoric of American democracy and the reality of how it has been experienced by Black folks, by immigrants, by poor people. And so never been comfortable with that gap, never been comfortable with that tension, and thinking about, you know, democracy and the power of the vote to sort of change our material circumstances and power, right? Mm-hmm. Like who has it, who doesn't, how much do we need in order to stop awful things from happening in our community? How much do we need to, you know, build the Georgia, build the America that our families deserve? And so again, you know, working class immigrant kid. So you do well in school, you go to the highest bidder. And so I went to the company that offered me the most money when I graduated, because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. And while I was very good at it, because my name is my name, shout out to Marlo Sanfield.
Exactly. What's up?
you know, so doing everything that I can to sort of bring about the change that I want to see in the world was really important to me. And so, but I got real clear that I wanted my 5 to 9, the work that I did on the evenings and on the weekends, the organizing, the community building that I was doing, that I thought that I could, that was what I was supposed to be doing. Like that's my calling. And so, you know, left the energy sector and moved into labor. And so, you know, again, getting more sophisticated about my power analysis, getting more sophisticated about how I organize people, organize resources. And I was living and working in Canada. You know, how a lot of people say, you know, when things get really tough and bad in the US, I'm moving to Canada. Well, I did it.
But you came back. So that says a lot about that analysis too. Yeah.
But I came back, and I came back because of Stacey. Lauren Grow Wargo and Stacey Abrams. Oh, yeah. You know, Lauren and I became friends when we were like young professionals in Ohio, right after I graduated from law school and was working for AFSCME. And she said, I want to introduce you to someone. She's a state rep in your hometown. Are you coming home for the holidays? I was like, have you met my mother? Of course I'm coming home for the holidays. Mama Upad is not about those games. came home, had a wonderful brunch on New Year's Day with Stacey. She laid out her vision for what the New Georgia Project was and what it could be. At the time, there were 1.2 million African-Americans, Latinos, and Asian-Americans in Georgia who were eligible to vote and completely unregistered. And why that number was significant was because when you started looking at top of the ticket races, going back over a decade in Georgia, the successful Republican was beating the losing Democrat by an average of about 250,000 votes. So between 200,000 and 300,000 was the win margin for Republicans in any statewide race, right? President, governor, United States Senator. And here there were five times the number of that gap of Black folks and people of color who weren't registered. So they weren't getting any phone calls. They're not getting mail. They're not getting knocks on their doors. They're completely not a part of our, you know, democratic process, our election process.
What year was this? Because people think that y'all just flipped Georgia in like a microwave second. So tell folk what year this was to add a little context to it.
Oh, this was 2014. So brunch on New Year's Day, ate the eggs, right? Drank the juice. Stacey laid out her vision. I was like, absolutely not, girl. Let me tell you all the reasons why this won't work in Georgia. And if you've ever met Stacey, you know that for every point that I was trying to make, she had a counterpoint that was solidly researched.
Always.
That was solidly researched. And I was convinced. And so, you know, that conversation, New Year's Day 2014, by Labor Day, I had packed up my truck with my worldly possessions and drove the 24 hours from Ottawa back home to Atlanta to start the New Georgia Project and our voter registration efforts the next day.
Man, so tell people, I mean, tell folk what it is. What is the New Georgia Project?
Yeah, so New Georgia Project is a nonpartisan civic engagement organization that we work to build what we call super voters, right? And super voters are voters who vote in every election in which
my mom and her friends, basically. Those are the super voters.
All the aunties, absolutely, vote in every election, right? You got a levy,
yes.
You got a special election, you got primaries, you got runoffs, they are there. But we have this theory, yep. Super voters are not born, that they're made. And so what is it that Black women know? What is it that senior citizens know that have them coming out every election? And how do we take those learnings and use it to construct better civic engagement programs that are more relevant, that, again, help us build super voters out of young people? Listen, the folks who voted for the first time in 2020 were born in 2002. And so, one.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
You're making me feel old right there.
How you think I feel? Right? Calling me ma'am, Miss Ense. Like, wait.
I know that. I'm like, man, Outkast is dope. And they like, Outkast? What is that? Like, who are they? I'm like, oh my God. They want to listen to Pooh Shiesty and everybody else. Anyway, I digress. Yeah.
Exactly. So today, we have helped over 500,000 young people and people of color register to vote in all 159 of Georgia's counties. And I think that that work continues, and it has had a noticeable.
How much did that cost you? How much did it cost you maybe per voter or just the overall budget you had, whatever you can give? Because people always say, I want to go into a state and register voters. How expensive was it?
Yeah, it's expensive. It is, I mean, not as expensive as having, you know, a Republican legislature who will let 12 hospitals in rural Georgia close. And, you know, a state that has the highest Black maternal mortality rate in the country and also in the world, amongst the highest, that you can be a wealthy African-American woman. And I have a higher chance of dying in childbirth if you're in Georgia. I feel like that's super expensive. But when we think about the cost of the legal defense to protect our work, because we are subject to a bunch of nonsense investigations into our work in an attempt to criminalize us as individual leaders and the New Georgia Project, the research that goes into the work that we do. So before we knocked on a single door, we, you know, are holding focus groups, single gender, mixed gender, single race, mixed race, urban, rural focus groups. Why do you vote? Why don't you vote? So that it informs all of our comms, our external communications, that just because we are Black-led, Southern-led, women-led organization, millennial and Gen Z, doesn't automatically make us experts in the politics of those communities. So when you factor in our bold and aggressive research agenda that informs everything that we do, we have the best lawyers in the Southeastern United States. The technology that we build that's designed to help us expose voter suppression, that's designed to, like, again, move people to action and sort of understand where our advocacy is. We're spending probably about $60 per person but here's the thing, our voters show up and they show up to vote. And so I think that if you look at, so probably it's just a standard garden variety voter registration effort, they're probably spending like maybe $15 or $20 per registrant, right? We are not interested in registrants. I mean, registration is a step towards becoming a voter towards becoming a super voter. And so $60 a vote does not seem crazy expensive when you think about the fact that these were becoming lifelong voters who are revolutionizing Southern politics.
You mentioned voter suppression. And so one of the things I want to talk about is SB 202. There's been a lot of reporting on the bill, but I wanted to drill down into it so that listeners fully understand the Republican playbook on suppression. What does the bill do around ballot drop boxes, and what's the practical impact of this for vote by mail?
Okay, well, what it does for ballot drop boxes is one, forbids them from being outside of the location, right? So they have to be inside. Why that is problematic is because for most people who are familiar with drop boxes, the normal business use of a drop box is to give customers access to the business outside of like traditional working hours. And so one, moving drop boxes inside the building limits access. It also limits the hours that folks have access to the drop box. So if the County Board of Elections is open from 9 to 5, then you have access from the drop box from 9 to 5. It adds an additional expense to the drop boxes because they are now required during the hours that the drop box is available to voters to have a security guard, a human, monitor the drop boxes as opposed to cameras, which were monitoring them before. And it caps the number of drop boxes. It caps the number of drop boxes that a county can have. So in 2020, you know, depending on the county, there was an average of about one drop box every like 3,000 to 5,000 voters, right? That the idea was, you know, make it available for people who want to vote by mail and vote in this particular way. And now the new legislation caps it that no county can have more than one drop box for every 100,000 voters, or one drop box for the entire county, whichever is lower. And so, yeah, to go from having one drop box for every, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 voters to having one drop box for every 100,000 voters is designed to target our urban areas and our densely populated areas, aka our areas where there are tons of Black voters, voters of color, and progressive white voters. And so the evil of Senate Bill 202, when you look at all of its pieces, is that many of these interventions appear to be race neutral on their face, but in fact, they are not.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go through a couple more. Talk about the bill's voter ID requirements, particularly how requiring a voter's driver's license number, last four digits of a social security number, or a photocopy of an ID when requesting an absentee ballot makes it harder for certain voters, particularly older Black voters, to vote.
Not only does it make it more difficult for older voters and poor voters and folks in rural parts of the state, but it also subjects them to identity theft, identity fraud. And that is not hyperbole. Our current governor, our asterisk governor, when he was Secretary of State, oversaw the largest data breach of voters' information in Georgia history. So much so that they were they made an offer of 1 year of identity protection to Georgia voters because all of their information, name, first name, last name, address, full social security number were breached and were just living on the internet, accessible to anyone who wanted to have access to them. And so the idea that requiring people to put their social security number on an application for an absentee ballot, it doesn't prevent this alleged voter fraud that they seem so concerned about. That this is designed to construct additional hurdles that people have to clear in order to get access to an absentee ballot. And the thing that makes it most egregious, despite the fact that it's targeting poor people and elders, is that Georgia voters have been voting this way for 16 years. While most states in the country, you know, expanded absentee balloting because of the pandemic, right? It was the safest way to vote, safe in terms of managing voters' exposure to COVID, but also safe in terms of having a paper trail. That wasn't the case in Georgia. We've been voting this way for 16 years. It's just that Republicans have been the most frequent users of absentee balloting. And now that everybody did it, there's somehow a problem with it that needs to be fixed. It's not a good idea. Again, it appears race neutral on its face, but we know that there are tons of older folks who, particularly born in rural parts of the state, particularly born in the rural Black Belt, who were born before, you know, birth certificates were mandatory.
Let me ask one more question about something else that I picked out to be very problematic. I brought it up on CNN and every other place. Early voting is expanded, but the bill prohibits mobile voting centers. And one of the things that I've not just preventing those mobile voting centers, but it also allows the Republican run state elections board to commandeer local election boards. Can you walk us through why this is problematic, especially when you're thinking about Fulton and DeKalb County?
The mobile voting centers were an example of how county government can be innovative and helpful in expanding access to democracy. Again, in a place like Fulton County, which is notorious for these crazy long lines that voters have to suffer through, particularly Black voters have had to suffer through in order to get access to the ballot. The idea of having county election workers bring an RV that's tricked out and that people can get in and get out and vote for them was genius. It was awesome and it was effective. And the only reason to ban the practice is to make it more difficult for people to, you know, vote freely and comfortably and in a reasonable time frame, period. Like, there is no legitimate public policy reason to ban it. It was staffed by the county. It was their idea. They funded it. And so this is an example of the state legislature, particularly our Republican-led state legislature, attempting to put their thumb on the scale, much like this takeover provision in the bill as well. And the idea being that if they deem a county to be poorly performing, which, let me add, they refuse to define.
Of course they do. Yeah.
That they are allowed to replace the county elections worker, the supervisor, and overturn the results of an election. So that's on the county level. And then on the state level, they removed the Secretary of State as the chair of the state elections board. So he was the secretary of state in Georgia, as in most states, is the chief elections officer. Like they are the, that's where the buck stops as it relates to election administration. And so they fired Brad Raffensperger, and now he is a non-voting ex officio member of the state elections board. And again, that was punishment for refusing to participate in Trump's criminal conspiracy to steal an election.
Let me ask you just a couple more questions, because this is kind of fascinating to me. I want to talk about where we go now. So, you know, what's the game plan for taking this to courts or getting it struck down? I know we don't have the Voting Rights Act or that it has been gutted. Let me not say we don't have it. It's been gutted. So I want you to talk about that. But I also want you to talk about it in relationship to, if it's still on the books in 2022, what's plan B for groups like the New Georgia Project? How do you fight the good fight and get our friends elected and reelected if this is still on the books, which is a very real possibility?
Right. So a couple of things. I think that we are coming at this from a number of different angles. One, we've filed a lawsuit within the hour of Governor Kemp signing the bill into law under that racist ass photo or painting. Mm-hmm.
The plantation he found. He was like, how many white guys can I find to take this picture under a plantation photo? Let's do that. And then they arrested a black woman outside. So they had the trifecta going. Yeah.
100%. So we filed a lawsuit in federal court with our colleagues, our comrades, our homies from Black Voters Matter and from RISE, which is a youth organizing outfit that, you know, we feel very confident that that will be successful. But to your earlier point, it might take some time to work its way through the courts. Secondly, is that we have launched and are, you know, powering through with this corporate accountability campaign, that we have, you know, brought Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines and most of the Fortune 500 to the democracy side, the pro-democracy side of this fight, that despite the fact that the Chamber of Commerce was scrambling to finally put together their statement of opposition, that by then we had already had multiple rounds of CEOs taking out full-page ads in the New York Times, decrying these anti-voting bills that have been introduced in 47 states across the country. And so that work continues, that we address the, we're in annual meeting season right now, so we've addressed the shareholders with a shareholder resolution at Coca-Cola's annual meeting, and that that work is continuing, that, you know, despite the fact that they are not movement organizations or movement leaders, that America's CEOs have picked a side in this democracy fight. And so I expect that to continue as we head to our third intervention, which is HR 1 and HR 4. That or well now S1, that the For the People Act is designed to set a federal standard for elections, that there should be a floor. Now, states are free to do better than what the federal minimum is, but this no more of this piecemeal patchwork approach, like some states got 15 days of early voting, some states have 21, et cetera, that we're setting a federal standard for elections that all states will have to abide by. And then HR 4 is, you know, full restoration of the Voting Rights Act. So I think that it's a legislative play, it's a litigation play, it's a organizing play.
It's a corporate play and an organizing play. My last question for you is this. One of the things I appreciate most about the New Georgia Project is all of the work that you do in rural communities in Georgia. Most people think Georgia's Atlanta and Savannah, like Chatham and Fulton and DeKalb. And I'm like, you can't win no election like that. And Democrats ran elections like that for a long time. But national Democrats in particular seem to forget that if you lose those rural areas by less, you can win statewide. My friend Andrew Gillum learned that. He got crushed in places where if he just would have won a few more votes or win a couple more times, you might have seen the difference in those 30 some odd votes. And they cheated Andrew, but you got to do everything you can to overcome that. Mm-hmm. So talk about the challenges and the key differences in organizing and activating in rural communities. And, you know, my friends in South Carolina always say, we want to replicate Georgia, but it takes time. It took you 7 years, 6 years to get to where you go. So talk about those challenges in rural South Carolina before I let you go.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a long history of, you know, name it, the DNC, the DCCC, the DSCC, the DLCC, the whole alphabet soup of both sides of the aisle actually coming into the South. finding their favorite pastor, bringing their street money, their trash bag full of cash, and saying, turn your people out, and then going away, right? No data, no analysis, no infrastructure that was built, just, you know, an exchange of cash temporarily to their favorite leaders. And that's not how you build power. And so I think that one, changing the culture of elections and how elections get done, I think is one of the biggest challenges, particularly when you're starting to think about America's rural Black vote. I think two, it is, you know, challenging this sort of crisis of imagination, sort of belief that, well, there's a couple of things. One, when you talk about rural voters, most people hear that it is code for a white conservative voter. And it's just not the case. It's just not the case at all. Not in Georgia, not in South Carolina. And so making sure that one, people understand that not only are there tons of people of color, but there are a bunch of white progressives that can be organized. And then I think three, leveraging and supporting indigenous networks. And
like, yes, not coming in thinking you know everything. You don't know everything. That people that have been doing the work.
Tell the people, Bakari, tell the people that there is infrastructure, right? That you might not, it might not be familiar to you. You might not recognize it as such, but there is infrastructure. And so how do we, you know, give them the resources that they need, because they know what their communities need. They know what the hopes are, the fears are, the aspirations for themselves, their families, their neighbors. And so like the way that we train our organizers is that you have twice as many ears as you do mouths. And so it is absolutely important that you are listening to the people, because they will tell you what they need and tell you what winning looks like. And then we get to work.
Man, we could be here all day. I just want everybody to know how dope you really are. Insay, thank you so much. As soon as I run my race, Stacey better pay you more, because I'm coming to snatch you up. We're going to go out here. We're going to change the world. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for all you do.
We have plans for South Carolina.
Let's do it, because I'm listening. I'm helping. Whatever you need. I'm writing checks and I'm knocking on doors. And I've got these focus groups on lock. So I'm down. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Have a blessed day. Before I let you go, this is a special outro. I wanted to talk about this most recent class of inductees into the National Basketball Hall of Fame. In case you missed it this past weekend, the 2020 class of the National Basketball Hall of Fame inductees were named. And the headliners of that class were the late Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, and Tim Duncan. This is arguably the greatest class ever of inductees, as the three headliners in Kobe, Garnett, and Duncan led the post-Jordan era of the NBA that was characterized by an era of parity across dynasties with the Lakers, Spurs, and Celtics that is still one of the golden eras of professional basketball. And it goes without saying, not having Kobe with us is still a massive loss. But this weekend's ceremony, where his wife and daughters accepted his nomination in his honor, was a fitting tribute to a legend and a legendary class of initiates. So, congratulations to the 2020 class, and our love goes out to the Bryant family, who continues to honor Kobe's life with the kind of class and grace befitting a legend. And that's that on that. We'll see all of you guys on Thursday. Thank you so much for subscribing, sharing, and downloading the Bakari Sellers podcast.